Hi, Damien Carrick here. Today we're in the air with a Law Report feature on the uncertain future of tiny airports. Our pilot is producer Lynn Gallagher. So fasten your seatbelts because she's still learning how to fly and landing isn't her strong point yet.
Coming into base, but the thing is not to hit the tree. Pull the power back, keep the nose, hold the nose.
Bring the power back for...
Just didn't lose any height.
What's happening is that you're staring too much at unnecessary things.
Yeah, and in those moments...
Other things go pear-shaped. Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got a lot to learn. But it's not just flying the plane safely. It's the rules and the politics behind them that make life difficult for a student pilot. It may surprise you to know, but nowadays the sky is far from free.
We did anything until people started telling us what we could and couldn't do. We just did things. Go where we wanted to. There must have been regulations for the airlines, but they didn't seem to apply to private people. We did what we wanted to.
Ron Dickinson, 91 years old, flying since 1944. And needless to say, flying isn't like this anymore.
No radio, no regulations, you know. We'd just taxi out in the Tiger Moss and... the duty tower would give you an orders lamp, 3 greens and you can go off. After that, you're on your own. Do what you like. No one
even cares. Over a busy city like Melbourne.
I lived up in Studley Park Road and I used to fly out there and I'd do aerobatics over Kew there over our home, and Mum would come out and she'd wave a towel or a sheet or something, so I'd flap my wings a bit, I've seen you, Mum. Fly back again.
There's not too many aviators left with Ron's kind of logbook. Why? Because the infrastructure is disappearing.
I think a lot of people don't realise that 40, 50 years ago, there were at least 16 small airports encircling Melbourne. But over the years, many of these airports have vanished. And so whereas, say, 20 years ago there were 16, there are now only about 11. And it's very sad because most of these ones that have gone, of course, are now covered with houses.
Can you name them?
Whittlesea, Berwick, Phillip Island, Geelong. That was a great loss for that area. The one on the Hume Highway. Wallen.
Melton, Muriduck, Pakenham, Welshpool and La Batouche could be added to the list. This is Neroli Merridew, one of the owners and operators of Lilydale Airport. And if she were to cast the net a little wider and include regional Australia, we'd be here all day. Victoria is the worst state for tiny airport closures. But the situation's similar in New South Wales and not great on the Sunshine Coast. Because in these places... unlike in remote Australia, the car is an alternative. Their struggle to survive became clear to me when I started flying lessons.
Beautiful.
Leongardo traffic, uniform Oscar Romeo. Charlie, this is Mike Tango
Sierra.
Just relax that hand a little bit more.
Traditionally, small airports are where the flying schools are. This is Tyabb in Victoria on the Mornington Peninsula, and above us is a demonstration of what a pilot should do in case of engine failure. It's also a demonstration of good training and how safe these small aircraft actually are.
Windmilling there. He's setting it up for a glide. You see the prop has stopped. That prop is dead stopped. Look at that. Wow. What a great display.
So why are tiny airports closing down when globally aviation is booming? It's not just the real estate pressure, although that doesn't help. Pilots and plane enthusiasts say when it's not simply about public transport, communities and city councils don't understand what aviation is for.
My name's Bridget Conroy. I currently work for Raybine Airport Consulting as a principal consultant, and I've been in the aviation industry for 25 years as a pilot, as an administrator, as an operator, and as an academic, yeah.
Bridget Conroy is one of the few people who knows what tiny airports are up against. As the former general manager of Bendigo Airport, she raised millions for its new runway. It took years and a great deal of consultation.
But there are different kinds of airports, and airports serve different purposes across the board. So I get the international, I get the domestic, but after that, it's pretty unclear in terms of policy what airports do. The main parameter in defining an airport is your regular public transport, so having an airline. But it's not feasible for every airport to have. It doesn't make sense. So one of the main things when I look at what is a regional aerodrome, and it's important to look at what its role and function is and how it contributes to its community. That will then, if we understand who we are, then it helps to know what to do next.
Marava traffic, pass the RXI base, 10, Marava.
405, control service terminates. There's no additional.
Bridget says tiny airports are the foundation, the backbone to flying. They're where the training, the crop dusting, the mail, maintenance, banking and emergency services, the survey, charter and recreational flying all take place.
Multiple tasks, as in multiple roles and multiple functions. So I see RPT, which is international and domestic aviation, as only one parameter, one measure of what an airport can do. The great thing about it, though, is you can measure it. General aviation is very hard to measure. So in a place like Bendigo Airport, we've got flight training, we've got charter activity. But how do you measure that? How do you know who's coming and going? So I'm seeing airports across the country increasingly, especially some of these smaller airports, start to take notice and record who's coming and going. And all of a sudden they realize they have all this activity happening at their airport that they didn't know happened there. So that helps to educate your council on what's actually happening out there.
And educating the city council is critical, because in a little-known slice of Australian history called ALOP, the Aerodrome Local Ownership Plan, city councils, rather than the federal government, became the owners of hundreds of aerodromes around the country. Most of these handovers occurred in the 1980s and 90s, with the caveat that the local council couldn't sell, lease or dispose of the aerodrome without the written consent of the then Secretary of the Department of Transport. But now the maintenance bills are due, and aviators feel that cash-strapped city councils are looking on this gift as more of a burden. ALOP says they can do anything but close the airport down. They can even mothball it by imposing impossible regulations, which is what John Glynn is afraid might be happening in Gympie.
The council decided to put ridiculous restrictions on the operators at the airport. I quite personally think council can't do what they're doing.
John Glynn, Queensland solicitor of 40 years and aviation specialist. He's also on the board of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association.
My understanding is that there were noise complaints. The council announced that there were some near misses, which I understand may not have been correct, as the reason for placing restrictions. But the restrictions they placed on the airport were, to say the least, ridiculous. One of them was no hovering, which would ban and prevent any helicopter from operating from that airport, because the helicopter's got to hover at some stage. They banned what they call low-level circuits. Well, I'm not sure what that means, because the regulations set out the height the circuit must be flown at, that is to fly around an airport. And they required that pilots use a mandated frequency. Well, the airport has what's called a CTAF frequency, which they have to use when they're operating within the airport. So a lot of the restrictions, a lot of the things they said were pretty stupid from an aviation point of view. But
so that if they knew what they were doing, they wouldn't have imposed those regulations?
Well,
those,
if they'd got some advice, yes, they wouldn't have. The non-hovering thing was the one that got me, because that means if the emergency helicopter had to get into Gympie to pick someone up, they couldn't land at the airport.
What's interesting in this, and what's really important, is the council implementation of the restrictions in itself are almost ridiculous.
And this is Ben Morgan, the Executive Director of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association.
Let's look at the cause in terms of government and local council not having an understanding of how general aviation fundamentally works. And that is, we have a situation where we have a local government that has had an airport in its region since the 1960s, and through local government planning failures, has allowed residential development to get closer and closer and closer to the aerodrome. Now, that aerodrome is, I believe, some 18 kilometres away from the township, and it was always built away from the township to keep the noise issues away from the town centre. And now we get to this arrival point where council in its own master plan recognises that the aviation businesses are in a phase of growth, that they're having a positive impact on the local economy, but then overnight, without consulting with the aviation tenants, introduces restrictions that effectively preclude and prohibit the very activity that the council comments as being an economic driver. And so there is a certain absurdity to these types of behaviours, and usually these actions by local government and private airport owners are thrust in and are enforced on the back of hyped up, pumped up, and in some cases, completely fabricated safety concerns.
As it turns out, it appears that in Gympie, the safety concerns were exaggerated. But we'll get to that later. In the meantime, a call for community consultation in relation to the Gympie airfield closed on September the 8th, and the City Council, when I contacted them, said they were still considering their response and unable to speak to me. So the new regulations banning hovering, low-level circuits and night flying haven't yet been enforced.
The strip's longer than the town. The town's as wide as the runway.
But whatever happens, the local council's in a no-win situation. Which brings me back to ALOP, those pesky aerodrome local ownership plans. How legally binding were those agreements?
Oh, I suppose they're as legally binding as someone wants to force the issues with them. The Commonwealth Government doesn't seem to be too interested in doing it, and I suppose the councils get away with it. Once it's done, it's done, because it becomes council's land and they can deal with it as they see fit.
I think in Victoria, part of the problem was some of the paperwork was lost in the amalgamation of city councils. Does that seem likely?
Nothing would surprise me with councils. No, I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. And the problem was, we're talking about 30 years ago now, so a lot of the paperwork would have gone missing.
In Gympie, missing paperwork isn't the problem. As Paul McEwen, chief pilot and head of operations of the recreational flying company there, says, Gympie's aerodrome's been happily operating since 1966. It was handed over to the local council under ALOP in 1992, and all was going well until July this year, when problems surrounding other airfields in Queensland began to amplify the issues in this one.
It, for many years, was a fairly quiet country airfield, but on the Sunshine Coast, circumstances being what they are with access to airfields, Redcliffe, Caboolture, Caloundra being the other sort of regional airfields on the coast, have all suffered from the effects of overdevelopment, rising costs, and restricted operations. So as operations became more difficult at those airfields, aviators tend to move to the next airfield up the coast, and Gympie was the next viable airfield. So over the last decade particularly, the development of Gympie Airfield has really come along in leaps and bounds, and it is now a very vibrant and active community airfield. It's drawing people from all over Australia and around the world to come and participate in aviation here. It's created an enormous amount of employment and interest and vitality that, is pretty hard to measure, but we can be sure that it punches above its weight as a community asset. Really costs the council nothing. They have to mow the lawn occasionally, otherwise the airfield is fairly self-sustaining. So we're pretty pleased with the way it's going. We've been actively engaged with the council in the decade that we've been here in developing and improving the airfield for all participants. So as far as we were concerned, everything is going really well. We were pretty surprised when we woke up on the 29th of July to newspaper headlines telling us that council has decided to change the flying rules at Gympie after 12 near misses, they quote, and talk of near disasters and one thing and another. So we're pretty perplexed because we're an air operator certificate holder with CASA, and we're constantly involved in meetings with CASA and auditing processes, and we're tuned into the aviation safety system.
Were there 12?
So news to us.
The 12 near misses, did that happen?
Well, so this got our attention, and in the newspaper articles, and that's how we found out about it, the council reported that the Civil Aviation Safety Authority had met with them and advised them about 12 close calls at the Gympie Airport in the last 5 years. Now, when we went and investigated that a bit, So the Gympie Times went and interviewed CASA and got a statement to the effect that actually that wasn't true. You know, here's a quote from CASA. It says, according to Civil Aviation Authority spokesman, aside from one incident CASA considered reportable, the airport was not considered unsafe.
Peter Gibson, a spokesperson from CASA, confirms this. But planes, like cars, do crash. And images in the media from accidents, wherever they are, put enormous pressure on the Civil Aviation Safety Authority to introduce more and more regulation. Nevertheless, Peter Gibson says CASA is neutral.
Oh, look, we never suggested for one moment that Gympie was, by definition, unsafe. It was a question of making sure that everyone operating there followed the safety requirements for their particular types of flying that they were doing, and that it's all working together in a systemic way so that the objectives of the local councils, the aerodrome operator, were being met. So we didn't have any safety concerns, but we certainly did offer some technical advice as to how to continue managing things successfully.
And was that advice taken on in the way you expected it, or was that advice misused?
Look, the advice was given in good faith, and we will continue to look at the operations at Gympie when it's appropriate. Obviously, if everyone's playing their part in delivering safe operations, then there's no need for us to get involved.
This is what it sounds like when CASA does get involved.
Do you have your licence on you?
Yeah.
This is a ramp check where pilots must show their licence, medical, maps, maintenance log, photo ID and flight manual to the authorities.
What class of medical?
Two.
Do you have photo ID?
Only a driver's licence.
Does this aircraft have a flight manual?
Yes, it does.
Does it have a maintenance
release? Yes, it does.
Can I see that the maintenance release is actually for this aircraft?
Here on the Law Report, we've got all that in order. So RN is fit to fly, and this is a program about tiny airports, with me, Lynn Gallagher, asking the question, why are so many of them on our eastern seaboard closing down? Pilots love to fly, and talking about flying. Remember Ron Dickinson, flying for 73 years? His stories are the best.
I remember flying out to Casey Field, which was down at Berwick. There were no buildings there then. Dick Casey lived alongside the aerodrome, or the field he made into an aerodrome, because he and his wife, they both used to fly. And the tales were that they had radio in their planes because they were more sophisticated. And people out there used to tell us at Essendon tales about the Caseys. They'd say, Lady Casey, she was a bit fumbly on the radio, but she'd say, Dick dear, where are you? I'm over here. And he'd say, oh, well, I'm not far away. I'll come over too.
And this is what the Essendon Tower sounds like today. You can hear the shuffling of the flight progress strips. Each strip has a particular call sign, aircraft type, the intended route, requested altitude, anticipated airspeed and scheduled time of arrival encoded onto it. And as the plane gets closer, the strip, like the plane, descends to the bottom of the rack. But the tiny airports we're talking about today don't have control towers. Instead, it's a respect for air law that stops planes from crashing into each other. Peter Gibson again.
There is a comprehensive set of aviation safety regulations underpinned by the Civil Aviation Act.
There's the Act, the regs, the CAPS. Tell me, what are the different aspects of the law?
There are a number of layers of the civil aviation legislation. There is the Civil Aviation Act, then there's the Civil Aviation Safety Regulations, which are the more modern safety regulations. There's an older set of civil aviation regulations which are gradually being phased out and replaced by the Civil Aviation Safety Regulations, so two lots of regulations there. And then sitting on top of that are some civil aviation orders, And then there's a whole bunch of advisory material, civil aviation advisory publications, advisory circulars and the like, all aimed at explaining in an easy, practical way how to actually apply the requirements that are in the regulations themselves.
So a lack of regulation is not the problem here. But this is where it gets complicated. Mildura, Warnerville, Kempsey and Yarram each face similar pressures to those being applied at Gympie. In a recent judgment involving a collision between a kangaroo and a landing aeroplane at Kempsey, an unfenced airfield, the judge found in favour of the plane owner. The city council was liable for the cost of a new propeller worth almost $200,000. A copy of this judgment is on the Law Report website. It makes you realise how particular the problems facing each tiny airport actually are, and how the councils have a balancing act between safety and management. I understand the decision is being appealed. In the meantime, it looks to the aviation community as if there will soon be a network of defunct airstrips all around Australia. And locally, it means that the passion, the energy and the expertise of those who've worked on those aerodromes for years could be lost. This is Yarram Airfield near Bass Strait in South Gippsland. The local aero club is meeting and Treasurer Robin Sidebotham is resigning in despair after 20 years of service.
And I prepared my letter of resignation as Secretary Treasurer, which I will hand in today. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the club's banking details note in a minute. All handed in.
All handed over.
Do you want to check to see if anything's missing?
Well, so you're stepping down as the Secretary Treasurer?
Yeah.
All right, well.
Is that okay for the minutes?
We'll make that noted and I'd say thanks very much for your service, Robin, for the last 12 months.
I'll second that.
Thank you,
sir.
It's heartbreaking. But agricultural pilot Rob Rebilliard, who knows Yarram well, says the pilots there shouldn't give up. He led his airport, Griffith, in New South Wales, through a similar crisis years ago. And that tiny airport's going well now.
They need to find out who's in council that really can sort of make a dollar out of it further on down the track. Find out exactly who wants to go into the area, who, you know, that's what they've got to do. And then you've got condition ratios that can be looked at. And the other thing is they have a duty of care to continue that resource that they've had there, which is an airport for light aircraft, agricultural aircraft, this, that and everything else. What they'll try and do is try and sell it to a private individual, with the excuse, oh, it's cost us too much, it's this, it's that and everything else. That's what they'll be trying to do. And someone needs to get in there in the nitty-gritties of it and find out exactly what's going on before they make the move. It's a bit like a harbour for a ship. If the weather's crook, the ship can go into the harbour until the weather clears. Same deal. All the other, it's been on our maps for years type of thing. If I'm in strife weather-wise, I'll look to land on Yarram Airport.
Yarram's in the electorate of the Federal Minister responsible for aviation, Darren Chester. He sometimes even lands at the aerodrome. His portfolio, infrastructure and transport, means roads and large airports. Tiny airports are a local matter. But he has set up a General Aviation Advisory Committee. I approached him for an interview, but he was unavailable. This didn't surprise Bridget Conroy, who says the federal government needs to show more leadership.
From a federal policy point of view, the federal government, they have responsibility to acknowledge the platforms that exist, to acknowledge the kinds of airports and functions, roles and functions that airports play. But sure, if they want to leave it up to other people to in their jurisdiction to deal with that, that's fine. But I think that your leader has to set the stage. So at the moment, the stage is set. In my view, the stage is set on airlines. Airports are good because they have airlines and they bring people to and from our country and within major centers within our country. I think that airports contribute a whole lot more to communities than that. And I think it is our leader the leaders of our country, I think it's their responsibility to set the stage.
Around the world, aviation is changing, and general aviation is where innovation takes place. It's our R&D, and tiny airports are the glue that holds this knowledge network together. Greg Bowles knows this from a wider perspective than Australia. He's the vice president of a global organisation called the General Aviation Manufacturers Association. It's a body trying to streamline regulations all around the world so that better, cleaner, quieter, safer aeroplanes are available to everyone.
One of the biggest changes in the last 10 years has been our expectations. And I think that we're just on the verge of seeing how we can evolve into some of these new technologies like electric propulsion that make it much easier and more reliable to operate the airplane. And things like, we call this simplified vehicle operation. So partially autonomous operations. Maybe the airplane looks to the pilot for guidance, but the pilot doesn't directly fly the airplane. And maybe the airplane can do most of the flight by itself. Maybe we add vertical flight to portions of the takeoff so you don't have to go to an airport. So all those technologies are just now at the verge of reality, and the historical aviation system doesn't easily allow new things. So there are very, very high regulatory burdens all around the world to doing things outside the box in aviation, and rightly so. You know, we want to make sure aviation is as safe as possible. But because the rules had been written in such high levels of detail back in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, trying to do something brand new today can be difficult. And so, you know, not only do we have to address and develop technologies that let us do these things, but these high regulatory burdens often make companies say, I just can't spend the time fighting the regulations to bring this to market, so maybe I'll go into the boating industry.
One company that's already marketing electric and hybrid planes is Pipistrel. It's a Slovenian company, and the general manager and founder, Ivo Boscarol, makes them in his factory using 3D printing. They're working with Airbus and the EU, but they're short-range planes, and so they'd have to hop from one tiny airport to another.
Well, you know, we made the machines which are noisy, which are energetically very demanding, like helicopters, you know, or polluting the atmosphere. We must design the aircraft in the way that flying without the engine is a normal procedure, not emergency procedure.
Back home, it's been one hell of a flying lesson. I'm up in the air, hoping, as I look to land, that Australia doesn't miss out on the next chapter of aviation history.
Putting a bit of right aileron and a bit of left rudder. Squeeze a bit of left rudder, squeeze a bit of left rudder. Right aileron.
Right aileron.
That's it. That's your crosswind right there.
Okay.
Off you go, don't delay.
Don't delay. Oh yeah, there's a gust.
Relax, Stuart, no, there's no gust.
Lynn Gallagher reporting from Up in the Air. And of course, the Law Report is available anywhere, anytime, especially on your ABC Listen app. Big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and technical producer this week, Melissa May. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next week with more Law.